The arts, theatrical, medical, and maternal, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with cultural historians Rachel Brownstein, Alice Kaplan, and Edward Cohen. Later on the show, critic Marianne Hirsch will be here with commentary about Mother's Day.
Stars are remarkable for doubleness above all. Perhaps they represent doubleness. They seem to be both singular and reminiscent, simultaneously false and true. As such, they reflect, reveal, and focus a problem that has preoccupied Western culture for some 200 years. The shape and depth of individual character, the outlines of the integral, coherent self, the relation between the substance of a self, sometimes called character, and appearances, self-presentations, temporary social roles.
Biographer Rachel Brownstein. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about her new book, Tragic Muse. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Stardom may seem to be a product of our media-made world. But before Madonna and Marlene Dietrich, there was Rachel, the 19th century French actress. Her performances are lost to us, but Rachel was one of the inventors of the star system. According to a new biography, Rachel single-handedly revived French classical tragedy, and with it, the lost ideal of glory, both personal and national. The book is Tragic Muse. The author is Rachel Brownstein of Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Rachel Brownstein argues in her book that her subject was a paradox. Although celebrated as an avatar of womanliness and high art, Rachel was also criticized for wanting too much money and too many lovers. Joining in the conversation now is Alice Kaplan, a professor of French at Duke University. I asked Rachel Brownstein to reflect on the title of her new book.
Well, I call her a tragic muse for several reasons. For one thing, because she did represent tragedy the way a muse does, and she was painted as the muse of tragedy in a very famous painting. Another reason is that one of the books which I discuss in my book, one of the novels in which she appears, is Henry James's novel, Tragic Muse, and that is about a girl who wants to be the English Rachel, an actress, a fledgling actress, who models herself on the great French actress.
Uh-huh. How did she get famous? I mean, there's a big order, but talk to me for a minute about
Well,
that.
I guess she got famous because there were a lot of journalists around who wrote her up, a lot of gossips, a lot of men who were interested in making her famous. Mm-hmm. It was an age in which young people were very much in demand on the stage in Paris and in which stars were looked for. And there were some very powerful men who got interested in her for complicated reasons, amorous and financial.
Uh-huh. Rachel, didn't she have a thing with Napoleon III?
No, that wasn't until she was famous. That, but he was not. Actually, her thing with Napoleon III started when he was in exile in England. And the story that Eugénie told after her husband was dead was that Napoleon, well, the future Napoleon III and his cousin Prince Napoleon and Rachel were together in a railway carriage in Scotland, and the future Napoleon III took a snooze and the carriage swerved and he was awakened to find his mistress, Rachel, in the arms of his cousin, Prince Nap, who was also known as Plon Plon. Uh-huh. She more or less seems to have attempted to sleep with every man who had been connected with Napoleon. Who was still alive in her time.
This speaks to the question of notoriety and what it means to be famous, whether politically or artistically. Alice Kaplan sitting here can tell us about how the French, for the French, this is nothing new. The French simply yawn at it, but we Americans seem to, we obsess about this kind of thing. Am I right, Alice?
Well, you know, we're very used to comparing everybody to Madonna. Perhaps we should compare Madonna to Rachel. What
do
they have in common?
Well, they were both poor girls from nowhere who became symbols of glamour and wealth and who became major attractions to all kinds of audiences. Uh-huh. Rachel was a great star, but she was a great star who represented very high-minded, exalted, elite art.
Let's pause on that for a moment. Tell me about the Comédie Française, that is to say, this, as you say, this very high-minded kind of thing.
Yeah, the Comédie Française is a very...
What does Rachel do to it? How does she come out of it?
Well, she came into it when it had fallen on hard times. The Comédie Française is still this national theater, the state theater of France, and it had been, in Rachel's time, it was only playing the classics, Molière, Racine, and Corneille. And because of the popularity of romantic theater, of the theater of Victor Hugo and later of Dumas, people were no longer interested in going to the Comédie Française in the late 1830s. And Rachel is remembered in theater history for making the Théâtre Français popular once again.
You know, Rachel, I think Americans would have a hard time visualizing what went on at the Comédie Française and what that classical theater looked like. What does Rachel look like when she's standing on the stage, and why is it different from our idea of dramatic acting?
Well, first of all, she stands precisely on the stage.
She doesn't move, you mean?
She moves as little as possible. She never raised an arm above her head. Her model was the classical statue. It was said that she went to the Louvre to study the postures of the statues.
That's great.
There.
That's great.
And in the Comédie Française, in the acting, the traditional mode of acting of the Comédie Française, there are gestures that one has to make at certain moments. There's a code of movements, and the movements are not extravagant.
Let's step back from the acting itself in the life of Rachel. Would you call her a reflector or a shaper of her times? I mean, how does she connect with larger sort of social and political issues?
Well, in my book, I try to argue that she was both, and that she became a star at a moment when people were particularly concerned with heroic individualism. It was after Napoleon, of course, and the idea of what a really remarkable person was still very much in the air, and there was a question of whether it was possible to be a remarkable character.
You know, in the American context, the name Rachel doesn't connote anything too much out of the ordinary, but in France in the 19th century, it's very much a Jewish name.
Because everybody, French people, normally were given saints' names, and she was very much a Jewish mm-hmm. actress. She first appeared on stage in Paris the year after the production of an opera called La Juive, The Jewess, by Halévy, in which the most famous and popular aria, everybody was singing it in 1837, when Rachel Condu-Seigneur, the heroine of La Juive, was named Rachel. So when little Rachel Félix, 15 years old, went on stage, somebody was smart enough to bill her simply as Rachel and to drop her last name. Various people claim credit for the idea.
Rachel, let me ask you a sort of a two-part question. You use the term postmodern biography to describe your book about Rachel. Tell me what that means. Unravel that one for me. And then come back to, you know, this passage that we heard you read at the beginning of our discussion. That is to say, the notion of the self. Amongst you academics, it's been said that this is a notion that's under attack. How about that?
Well, I suppose it is. I called it a postmodern biography because, as I see it, most biographies begin at the beginning of a person's life and move to the end and try to show that the plot in some way reflects the character, or sometimes doesn't. My book begins with the funeral of Rachel, not the death, but the funeral, the sort of public exhibition on the occasion of her death that brought 100,000 people into the streets of Paris, and proceeds to talk about the novels written by English writers in which she figures, in which her name resonates.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is somebody who didn't live very long.
Certainly not. She died at 37.
How did she die?
She died of tuberculosis. And the spectacle of her death, of her dying, was involved with her stardom all the way through. She played tragic heroines who died. And,
in other words, she was never off stage.
Well, I guess that's one way of looking at it. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And when she began, and people talked about her pallor, her sickliness. She was always very thin. She was very fragile. She was homely. She wasn't a beautiful woman, which was another extraordinary thing about her. But everybody was expecting her to die. That was part of her fascination. Watch this girl burn up on stage. Watch her waste away. Mm. And when she got sick, the newspapers were hungry for details about her dying.
Well, Rachel Brownstein, I want to thank you for coming by to talk about your new book. Let me mention it. It's called Tragic Muse, Rachel of the Comédie Française, just out from Alfred Knopf. And thanks to you, Alice Kaplan, for arranging Rachel's visit to Soundies. Let me also quickly thank the Women's Studies Program, the Department of History, and the Institute for the Arts at Duke University for their assistance. Alice, Rachel, good to see you both.
It's good to be here. I love Rachel's book.
Well, thank you, Alice. Thank you, Wayne.
It's Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Literature and the Medical Arts. Join me now for a conversation with biographer Edward Cohen. We'll talk about his study of the Victorian poet William Ernest Henley.
Here's a contemporary reaction to Henley's hospital poems by George Bernard Shaw. In Hospital is a horrible, fascinating, and wrong yet rightly done little book, which no one should be advised to read, and which no one would be content to have missed.
Biographer Edward Cohen of Rollins College. He's at work on a book about William Ernest Henley, the Victorian writer, who's probably best known today for a few lines from Invictus, his poem about being the captain of one's soul. In his own time, however, Henley was a successful journalist and editor, the first to publish W.B. Yeats and George Bernard Shaw. But his life changed personally and artistically when he entered Edinburgh's Royal Infirmary in 1873. Henley suffered from tuberculosis of the bones of his hands and feet. Over a period of 20 months, he was under the care of medical pioneer Joseph Lister and a nursing system inspired by Florence Nightingale. He named the poems he wrote about his medical experiences In Hospital. Edward Cohen says that In Hospital and its author clearly belong to the world of Victorian letters, but because of their strong autobiographical and subjective component, the poems also look forward to a central ingredient of literary modernism. Edward Cohen.
This was the crisis that defined his life. When Henley looked back on his hospital experience, he realized that he had endured, that he had written his greatest poems, his most successful poems about this experience, and he'd come through.
Give me a sense quickly of what the poems are about. You say they're autobiographical.
The poems are arranged in a sequence. There are 28 of them, and they're arranged in a chronological sequence. He begins with Enter Patient and describes the waiting room, describes the ward, describes the environs. Then he describes his operation, and then he writes sonnet portraits of some of the fellow patients and nurses and physicians, and writes some very subjective poems about how difficult it is to be recuperating in a Victorian hospital month after month after month.
Was this a form of therapy for Henley himself? I mean, does it fit into some sort of notion of medical literature? How do we place it into a context?
Well, I think that the notions that we have of medical literature are, I think they're stereotypical. We tend to think of medical literature as being therapeutic. As far as I can determine, Henley wanted very, very much to be a poet. Before he came to the hospital, he had written some terrible imitations of Swinburne that were published. But
Swinburne isn't himself doing too well
these
right. days.
That's right. But when Henley came to the hospital, he discovered a legitimate experience, a personal experience that was so important to him that that he created a new kind of poetry.
Did people read this stuff? Was it published immediately? And what kind of impact did it have?
Yes, they were published. In fact, they were accepted for publication in the Cornhill Magazine before he was even discharged from the infirmary. While he was in the infirmary, Leslie Stephen, editor of the Cornhill and father of Virginia Woolf,
right,
came to visit Henley and introduced Henley in turn to Robert Louis Stevenson. And the original manuscripts of the hospital poems have Stevenson's corrections on them.
Let's turn to the poems themselves. Ed, give me a quick sample from Henley in Hospital.
Okay. Lo, the hospital, gray, quiet, old, where life and death like friendly chafferers meet. I limp behind, my confidence all gone. The gray-haired soldier porter waves me on, and on I crawl, and still my spirits fail. A tragic meanness seems so to environ these corridors and stairs of stone and iron, cold, naked, clean, half workhouse and half jail.
Now, this is pretty depressing stuff. I mean, is there anything that brightens the picture? To put it bluntly, why would a modern audience pay attention to literature like this?
Well, in fact, I think that a poem like this anticipates modern literature. I mean, think about the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
The Victorian wasteland.
That's right. When a patient is etherized upon a table.
Right.
And in fact, what I find extraordinary about these poems is Henley's ability to combine both the dramatic and objective quality of Victorian literature, uh-huh, and the subjective and personal quality of modern literature.
One of the subjective elements here is his relationship with the nurses.
That's right.
And you have pointed out to me that that's an important ingredient in the composition of the poems and the way we should read them. What about that?
Let me tell you about the nurses. Here's a poem that I'd like to quote from just briefly. It's a portrait of a lady probationer who was a nurse in training. Her plain print gown, prim cap, and bright steel chain look out of place on her, and I remain absorbed in her as in a pleasant mystery. Quick, skillful, quiet, soft in speech and touch. Do you like nursing? Yes, sir, very much. Somehow I rather think she has a history. Now, what's extraordinary about that poem is that in many ways it's simply a conventional portrait of a nurse or a portrait of a character. And yet notice how Henley inserts himself. He uses a little bit of dialogue at the end of the poem, inserting himself, affirming his presence in the poem.
Now, that's one of the things that looks forward to what we call modern literature.
Absolutely.
The very subjective autobiographical role.
That's right. The Victorians had a very difficult time talking about their own experiences. And so what they tend to do is to invent fictive characters and to create dramatic situations in order to represent their emotions. Henley had no difficulty doing this whatsoever. He blends objectivity and subjectivity, and his poems are autobiographical. And readers of Henley's poems, the reviewers of the poems when they were published, responded to them as autobiographical.
Now, is your work, therefore, Ed Cohen, about Henley? I mean, are you something of an antiquarian, just sort of reviving this guy's reputation or looking at him on his own terms? Why is he important to a reader in the 1990s?
Well, I think one of the reasons he's important to us is that there is so much interest right now in literature of the human body, literature dealing with illness, dealing with what it's like to be a patient as opposed to what it's like to be a doctor, or the separation of the institution from the individual.
Uh-huh.
And so Henley's poems provide a wonderful case study of the experience of being a patient.
How do your students take to William Ernest Henley? Tell me about that very quickly.
I'm so invested in Henley and in his hospital poems that I try to focus on more major Victorians, because I think that my students would take advantage of me. I would go on for an entire term talking about Henley instead of the poets I ought to cover.
Uh-huh. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Ed Cohen. Give me another quick sample here of Henley in Hospital.
Here's a poem called Casualty, and what it describes is a victim of Victorian society. The Victorians were the first great industrialized society, and conditions, working conditions, were very, very difficult. Here's a poem in which Henley describes a railway worker who has fallen from the engine and been dragged along the rails. As with varnish red and glistening dripped his hair, his feet looked rigid, raised, he settled stiffly sideways. You could see his hurts were spinal. He had fallen from an engine and been dragged along the metals. It was hopeless, and they knew it. so they covered him and left him. Now, as the poem unfolds, there's an interesting dichotomy, because Henley is trying to be very objective in all of this, but he introduces this poor, wretched character's sweetheart who comes to his bedside and simply stands, looks at him, sighs a little, and departed without speaking as himself a few hours after. A poem like that is important because what it does is to mirror Henley's sense of himself, what it was like to be a victim in Victorian society.
Mm-hmm. Ed Cohen, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings, your discussion here of your work on William Ernest Henley. Let me mention your work. You are the editor of the annual Victorian Bibliography and Victorian Studies. You've written a book about Henley and Robert Louis Stevenson, and you are a professor of English at Rollins College down in Florida. Thanks for coming by to contribute to Soundings.
Thank you for having me.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. It's early May, and that brings us Mother's Day. With some thoughts about that, here's Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College.
Can I be a mother and a feminist? Can I be a feminist if I'm a mother? Or, conversely, can I be a feminist if I'm not a mother and not interested in being one? Do I have to be a mother to be a feminist?
Marianne Hirsch is a scholar of French and comparative literature. She's also a feminist and the mother of three children. Her books include The Mother-Daughter Plot, published in 1989. Here's Marianne Hirsch with some thoughts about feminism and Mother's Day.
Feminism and motherhood have maintained uneasy relations since the second wave of feminism began in the late 1960s. Before that, Simone de Beauvoir in 1949, and after, Shulamith Firestone in 1974, identified motherhood as the prime barrier to women's equality. If only the species could reproduce itself differently, they seemed to imply, if only women would resist the social pull toward maternity, we could enjoy some of the freedoms and achievements of men. Following their suggestion, equality feminists of the 1970s identified themselves as daughters celebrating sisterhood and breaking away from their mothers' lives, lives they associated with unacceptable compromises. Robin Morgan, now editor of Ms. Magazine, tells how she had to hide her love for her child in the mother closet since she felt unable to combine her own maternal identity with her feminist commitment. But by 1976, Adrienne Rich decried what she called feminist matrophobia. In our desire to become individuated and free, she said, we perform radical surgery, removing an essential part of ourselves. The difference feminists of the late 70s and early 80s sought the specificity of women's voices, of women's ways of knowing, by returning to motherhood and especially to mother-daughter relationships. Here they tried to find the sources of feminine tendencies toward connectedness and affiliation, as opposed to masculine values of autonomy and separation. But they wrote from the perspectives of daughters and with mixed emotions. We live in a culture that romanticizes motherhood and idealizes children, a culture dominated by fantasies of maternal omnipotence and by fears of maternal power, anger, and violence. It is difficult to speak dispassionately of mothers. Difference feminists were soon accused of essentializing women's experience, of returning women to the destiny of their anatomy. They were accused of excluding from the ranks of feminism those women who might choose not to mother or to nurture. Even worse, their critics accused them of being unable to envision a meaningful life for women separate from motherhood. By the mid-80s, moreover, differences feminists cautioned against any general notions of motherhood. They stressed radical differences among mothers, differences caused by race, class, economic status, sexual orientation. Where does that leave us now in the 1990s? Can we now work for a mother-inclusive feminism that does not elevate motherhood as the only goal for women? Can we create a feminism that recognizes differences among mothers? Can we conceive a feminism that includes maternal voices, without sentimentalizing or devaluing mothers? Can we have a feminism respectful of mothers that commits itself to speaking positively about women who are, and listen to our language, childless or not mothers? Let us affirm our respect for the work that mothers do by demystifying motherhood without blaming mothers. Let us, as a culture, as women and men, commit ourselves to do the work of nurturing strong and healthy children and strong and healthy women and men, even as we ensure that mothering remains a choice. We might begin by reclaiming Mother's Day as a day for mothers and for women, not for sending cards, but for talking among ourselves about our experiences. A modest proposal, but an ambitious starting point just the same. This is Marianne Hirsch at the National Humanities Center.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Rachel Brownstein of Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, Edward Cohen of Rollins College, and Alice Kaplan of Duke University. You also heard commentary by Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 658. That's program number 658, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, a conversation about H.L. Mencken, the Baltimore journalist and man of letters. Mencken biographer Fred Hobson will be here to talk with Hal Crowther, the most recent winner of the H.L. Mencken Award. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Lights, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The arts, theatrical, medical, and maternal, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with cultural historians Rachel Brownstein of Brooklyn College, Alice Kaplan of Duke University, and Edward Cohen of Rollins College. You'll also hear commentary about Mother's Day from Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College. The arts, theatrical, medical, and maternal. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.